I'm going to give you a rundown now of what it is that we're going to be listening to during the prepared portion of tonight's program. We may have too much material for one evening's broadcast, so if that turns out to be the case, I will pick up part two, I guess one could say, next week. Not tomorrow, but next week. I'm going to begin by relating a number of different things that appeared in the papers in a single week to each other. And beyond that, I suspect, it is my belief, that all of these things are connected by the role that they play in the descent of the United States into fascism. It has been my deep intellectual conviction for a long time that the United States is going the same route that Germany, Italy, and Japan went in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, and unfortunately, events seem to be bearing me out. We're going to be taking a look, first of all, at the capricious behavior of the dollar. It doesn't seem to be able to hold its own against the mark in the eyes of currency traders. That produced some serious intervention on behalf of the dollar. So far, that intervention has been relatively successful in keeping the dollar from collapsing. I'm not sure if that's necessarily going to be the case, but whether or not the dollar collapses, I think that this country is in for some serious economic problems, quite possibly disastrous. And I think the social dislocation and the political fallout from an economic collapse, when one comes, and I think one is coming at some point, that fallout is likely to be devastating. I see a number of things taking place that I think may very well represent parts of contingency planning to deal with the eventuality of an economic collapse in this country. Among the things that we're going to be relating, in addition to the frightening fluctuations of the dollar on the international currency markets, are the push for gun control. The House of Representatives has banned 19, quote, assault weapons, unquote. We're going to be talking, if we have time this evening, about gun control, the apparent intelligence community connection to gun control. We're going to be talking about Senator Thomas Dodd from Connecticut, who was on the U.S. prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg. He's a former FBI agent. He has connections to has had in the past connections to the American Security Council, an ultra-reactionary group with strong and overt fascist connections. And indeed, the work of Thomas Dodd and some of the committees that he has been involved with over the years crops up in the context of the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. We're going to be taking a look at such diverse things as gun control, the cry about immigration, the whining and bitching about, quote, immigrants, unquote, and all the harm they're doing to society. And we're going to be taking a look also at the growing sentiments for euthanasia in the United States. Now, some people may be thinking that, oh, there, old Dave's finally popped his cork, boy, relating the fluctuations of the dollar and the push for gun control and the growing sentiment for euthanasia and the revulsion and the hue and cry against immigration. Well, in my opinion, and I think facts and ultimately I think history will bear this out, these things are connected by a common thread. That common thread is fascism, and I think all of these things can be directly attributed to the descent of the United States into fascism. And beyond that, I think many of the things, such as the growing sentiment for euthanasia, the push for gun control, ultimately will be directly connected in terms of, quote, population control, unquote, in an economically collapsed and a politically restive America. After taking a look at a number of articles, and very briefly, too, taking a look at a number of articles in the paper having to do with gun control, the remembrance of the assassinations of Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King as necessitating gun control. By the way, that was also a finding of Senator Dodd's committee. We're going to take a look at a column by old Pete Wilson, old penis face Pete, raising a hue and cry about immigration. We're going to begin the substantive discussion after glancing at a few of these articles by taking a look at a column, an op-ed column that appeared in the New York Times on May 9th of this year. It was by a fellow named Walter Reich, a physician. And this particular column is called First, Do No Harm. And it's about the slide into euthanasia. And quite properly, this columnist has observed the growing push for euthanasia in the United States, and he has noted quite properly that the push for euthanasia in the United States is reminiscent to a certain extent of the euthanasia program, or the growth of the euthanasia program in Nazi Germany, and it was that program that led the way to the Nazi extermination programs. There's a miscellaneous archive show dealing with just exactly that eventuality. After that, we're going to take a look at a very important new book, and in fact, we're going to be making an addendum to an archive show called Euthanasia in Nazi Germany in Contemporary America. That archive show dealt with the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, the Nazi euthanasia program, which led ultimately to the Nazi extermination programs, and very significantly, that program discusses the profound relationship between the international mental hygiene movement, the international eugenics movement, the international euthanasia movement, and the scientists and social critics in Germany that helped pave the way for the Nazi euthanasia program, which in turn, as I've said, led directly to the Nazi extermination programs. We are going to be looking this evening at an important new book called The Nazi Connection, subtitled Eugenics, American Racism, and German National Socialism. This will be an addendum to that miscellaneous archive show done in the spring of 1988. And specifically, we're going to take a look at the profound connections between American eugenicists and racial theorists and their counterparts in Nazi Germany. We're going to take a look at the influence on Nazi eugenicists of their American counterparts during the pre-World War II and World War II periods. And we're also going to take a look in a big way at the evolution of contemporary eugenics and contemporary scientific racism in the United States. And we're going to take a look at, among other things, the work of Roger Pearson, the work of the Pioneer Fund. Roger Pearson, regarded with great favor by the Reagan administration, an associate of the World Anti-Communist League in the past. And the Pioneer Fund is an element which connects the racism and eugenics in the United States, which served as a model for the eugenicists and exterminators in Nazi Germany, with contemporary eugenicists and racial theorists. We're going to compare the people associated with the Pioneer Fund, or some of them, their work, with the alliance between American eugenicists and racists and their counterparts in Germany. We're going to take a look at how the American eugenics legislation and American scientific thinking and writing with regard to eugenics paved the way for the practice of, quote, scientific eugenics, unquote, in Germany. That practice, as we looked at in the miscellaneous archive show, and as we will see again this evening, led directly to the Nazi extermination programs. We're going to take a look at the extent to which American eugenicists received academic honors from Adolf Hitler, and in addition to looking at the way in which those eugenicists influenced the thinking of Hitler's minions, we're going to take a look at the extent, the way in which, I should say, American eugenicists lent respectability and credibility to Nazi eugenics, and the awarding of academic distinctions and academic honors to American eugenicists by Adolf Hitler was a central element in that. We're also going to take a look at the similarity between the nature of the criticism directed at the critics of Nazi eugenics by the Third Reich in the pre-World War II period with the rhetoric that is generated by contemporary eugenicists and racial theorists to criticize their enemies. And in many ways, the arguments are very similar. We're also going to take a look at the relative exoneration of the Nazi eugenicists during the doctor's trial at Nuremberg in 1946. Because of the profound connections between American eugenicists and American social legislation and both their intellectual and legislative counterparts in Germany, the prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, not surprisingly, went very lightly on the Nazi eugenicists. The vast majority of them were reincorporated into the academic, respectable, quote-unquote, academic community in Germany, as well as the rest of the world. And we're going to take a look at the gentle hand, the judicial restraint that was exercised against the Nazi eugenicists by the prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, the way in which they were able to, the Nazi eugenicists, that is, who paved the way for the Nazi extermination programs, the way in which they were able to return to academic and intellectual respectability. And indeed, we're going to take a look at the connections between some of those individuals and the Pioneer Fund. Again, a historical link, an institutional link between the American and Nazi eugenics of the pre-World War II period and the scientific racism of the contemporary period here in contemporary scientific racism here in the United States. One of the key members of the American prosecutorial staff at the doctor's trial, the euthanasia trial at Nuremberg, was a fellow named Leon Jaworski, a Polish-American lawyer who went on to become better known for his work as the Watergate special prosecutor, later the Koreagate special prosecutor. We're going to be taking a look this evening at what may very well constitute what Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley professor and researcher, has termed deep politics. Indeed, we're going to be looking at some possible deep politics this evening that is considerably deeper than anything that Professor Scott, who merits serious consideration as the foremost political intellect in America today, has ever at least publicly considered. We're going to be taking a look at the political resume, or the legal resume, it's actually a political resume as well, of Leon Jaworski. We're going to begin by going back to Leon Jaworski's work during the Second World War. Specifically, we're going to take a look at an old archive show dating from 1984. In fact, this may even date, it's from 1984, about Leon Jaworski's role as a prosecutor in a case in which an anti-Nazi member of the Wehrmacht, and a prisoner of war in an American POW camp during World War II, was murdered by his more enthusiastically Nazi compatriots, who, interestingly enough, were aware of his distaste. The unfortunate corporal's name was Corporal Kunz, and he was murdered. He was beaten to death in very cruel fashion in an American POW camp by his more ardently pro-Nazi comrades, who learned about his distaste for Adolf Hitler because they, that is to say, the ardently pro-Hitler POWs in the American POW camp, were allowed to screen the mail of their comrades in arms. They were, of course, allowed to do this by the American officers in charge of the camp. And when this shocking dereliction of duty resulted in the death of one of the POWs, there was a very cursory investigation, an investigation which was limited to the German Nazi POWs and which did not, surprisingly, involve the evident complicity of some of the American officers in charge of that camp, who, for whatever reason, were allowing the ardently pro-Nazi POWs to police their less enthusiastic comrades. Of course, that represents collusion between the American officers and the men who were their supposed enemies. That collusion, though, representative of a deep, deep political collusion between American industrialists and financiers, American racial theorists, as well as some American national security personnel and their counterparts in Nazi Germany, that collusion was covered up by Leon Jaworski, who was brought in as the prosecutor in this particular case and limited the investigation to the German aspects. He did not get into the pivotal collusion between the American officers and the POWs who they were supposedly keeping track of. That collusion led directly to the death of Corporal Kunz, and it is indicative, at the very least, of an unwillingness on the part of Leon Jaworski to ruffle the feathers of those in power. It might even be indicative of some deeper pro-fascist sentiments on the part of Leon Jaworski. That remains entirely speculative. But certainly, whatever his motivation, Leon Jaworski acted in a manner in his handling of the killing of Corporal Kunz, which was beneficial to fascism. Later, as a member of the prosecutorial staff at the euthanasia trial in Nuremberg, Leon Jaworski was among those who was less than vigorous in his pursuit of the Nazi eugenicists. Those Nazi eugenicists were, of course, directly connected to their American counterparts, and the role, again, of the American eugenicists and racial theorists in laying the intellectual foundation for the Nazi eugenics, euthanasia, and extermination programs is one of the major focal points of the program this evening. Again, in the trial, in the Nuremberg trial of the doctors, the euthanasia trial, Leon Jaworski was a key prosecutor, and the outcome of those trials was once again determined by what might be termed, what might be euphemized as judicial restraint, quote, judicial restraint, unquote. Of course, Leon Jaworski, as we have seen, went on to become the special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry. That was the body put together by then-Texas State Attorney General Wagner Carr to investigate the assassination of President Kennedy. Leon Jaworski also served as the liaison between the Texas Court of Inquiry and the Warren Commission, where he also was a counsel. Leon Jaworski was in charge with seeing whether or not Lee Harvey Oswald had connections to intelligence agencies. Oswald had more intelligence connections than a porcupine had quills, but Leon Jaworski managed to find none of those, once again indicating at the very least an unwillingness to ruffle the feathers of those in power, if not an overt sympathy for fascism. And with his role as the special counsel to the Texas Court of Inquiry, we once again find Leon Jaworski acting in a manner which benefits fascism. And as we looked at in numerous, as we have seen in numerous archive shows, at the core of the conspiracy surrounding President Kennedy's assassination was an explicitly fascist milieu involving elements associated with the World Anti-Communist League, the American Security Council, and a number of other American and European fascist elements that we have dealt with in past archive shows. I'll go into that at greater length as when we get into the main body of the prepared portion. Interestingly enough, the fellow counsel of Leon Jaworski on the Texas Court of Inquiry was a fellow named Robert G. Story. Robert G. Story, by the way, that's spelled S-T-O-R-E-Y, was a former president of the American Bar Association, also a dean, I believe it was, with Southern Method University. But interestingly enough, it was Robert G. Story who, as Colonel Robert G. Story, passed the word down through the American prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg that the denazification provisions were to be relaxed. That information, by the way, coming from the very fine new work by Christopher Simpson, The Splendid Blonde Beast. It's actually not that new. It came out in 93, but it's relatively new. It is interesting to me and possibly significant that the two selections for the Texas Court of Inquiry or the people to serve as special counsels were Leon Jaworski and Robert G. Story, both of whom were less than vigorous in their pursuit of Nazi wrongdoing during the Nuremberg trials, because at the core of President Kennedy's assassination, and specifically operating in the Dallas-Fort Worth area, were a lot of people who were alumni of the Third Reich and who were performing the same sorts of services here in the United States that they had performed for Adolf Hitler during World War II, i.e. killing people and destroying democracy. The Wagner Carr, Jaworski, Robert G. Story, Nuremberg connection is one which raises many more questions than it answers. One of the questions, the main question it raises in my mind, is just how far back some of these roots actually go, and the extent to which the selection of Robert G. Story and Leon Jaworski to serve as counsels to the Texas Court of Inquiry was with knowledge of not only, I wonder to what extent that selection, those selections were made with knowledge, first of all, of who was actually responsible for the assassination of John Kennedy, and beyond that, with knowledge of the historical fact that neither Robert Story nor Leon Jaworski would pursue with any degree of vigor an investigation of Nazis. We're going to take a look at the denial of liberty to people attempting to flee Haiti by way of taking a look at contemporary American policies towards immigration, and in particular immigration by people of a race that is regarded with disfavor by the powers that be in the United States. Obviously, the vast majority of people attempting to get to the United States from Haiti are of African extraction. The United States has been deeply complicit with the junta currently illegally holding power in Haiti. And the Bush administration was instrumental in seeing to it that those fleeing fascism in Haiti, fleeing totalitarianism in Haiti, would not find refuge in the United States. And interestingly, though not surprisingly, the individual who has played a pivotal role in denying Haitians immigration was a Luftwaffe veteran named Gunter Wagner. We're going to be taking a look at a short discussion of Gunter Wagner's role in blocking Haitian immigration as the next item up in the program this evening, by way of taking a look at immigration control, the arguments against it, and the extent to which they are central to the development of fascism at an intellectual slash political level in the United States. That particular item will come from an article in the latest issue of Covert Action Information Bulletin, an article, ironically enough, written by a person who is relatively disreputable, but even a blind pig finds an acorn once in a while, and this blind pig found this particular acorn. That may be all we have time for this evening, but if we have more time, I suspect this will bleed over into next week's program, and the term bleed over is an appropriate one under the circumstances. What we're going to look at next week is the push for gun control. We're going to take a look, or if we have time this evening, I guess we'll look at it. We're going to take a look at the extent to which some of this country's political assassinations, the assassinations of John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, Martin Luther King, and others, have been used to justify gun control. In fact, those assassinations were committed by an explicitly fascist milieu within the American power structure, and no amount of gun control would possibly have prevented those assassinations. But the fact of the matter is that those assassinations have been used in order to generate sympathy for gun control in the past. We're going to take a look at the push to outlaw assault weapons. After that, we're going to take a look at Bill Clinton's bringing up of the subject of America's political assassinations by way of pushing for gun control. We're then going to take a look, first of all, at the curious behavior of former United States Senator from Connecticut, Thomas Dodd, a former FBI agent, also someone who was on the prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg. Thomas Dodd was instrumental in helping to float the fascist disinformation that linked Lee Harvey Oswald to the KGB, and in turn to a KGB assassination training program, which also supposedly trained Bogdan Stashinsky, the individual who assassinated Ukrainian fascist, Third Reich, and CIA collaborator Stefan Bandera. The murder of Stefan Bandera was linked by elements associated with what was to coalesce as the World Anti-Communist League to the assassination of President Kennedy. And we're going to take a look, first of all, at Senator Dodd's connections to the floating of that particular piece of disinformation that we looked at in Radio Free America shows 15 and 37. We're then going to take a look at Senator Dodd's connections to the American Security Council. That was a private right-wing security outfit which grew directly out of the filing system of American fascist and Third Reich collaborator Harry Jung and his American Vigilance Intelligence Federation. One of the founding people, one of the driving forces behind the American Security Council was former U.S. General Charles Willoughby, nee Karl Adolf von Zschäpe und Wiedenbach, a German-born fascist whose idol was Francisco Franco. That same German-born fascist and Franco admirer was the top-ranking U.S. intelligence officer for General Douglas MacArthur for many, many years. Charles Willoughby, a linchpin of American fascism, has been cited in the recent book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, as in all probability a pivotal figure behind the assassination of President Kennedy. Certainly the American Security Council has strong links to the former World Anti-Communist League, and with the forces of international fascism. Elements associated with the American Security Council crop up repeatedly in connection with the investigation into the assassination of President Kennedy. Not surprisingly, Thomas Dodd, again, like Leon Jaworski, like Robert Story, was a member of the prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, and that prosecution was a very, very tepid one, characterized by the, quote, judicial restraint, unquote, that has characterized the career of Leon Jaworski. After that, we're going to take a look at Peter Dale Scott's speculation concerning Lee Harvey Oswald's role as a U.S. government informant, specifically an informant involved in the investigation of the mail order firearms business. It is an entirely speculative item, one that is delineated as such by Professor Scott. It is interesting, though, that Oswald's work, if in fact the speculation is accurate, parallels the work of one of the committees chaired by Senator Thomas Dodd. That work later was to bear fruit in the 1968 Gun Control Act, which in part at least drew on the mythology surrounding American political assassinations to justify the implementation of gun control legislation in the United States. We're going to take a look at what Senator Dodd's committee, Senate Judicial Subcommittee was looking at. We're going to take a look at Oswald's work, possibly connected to that committee. And later on, we're going to take a look at Manny Pena, the Los Angeles policeman and a former U.S. intelligence operative who was centrally involved in the investigation quote, investigation, unquote, into the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Many people have cited the former intelligence work of Manny Pena and his colleague Enrique Hernandez on Special Unit Senator as calling into question the veracity of the findings into the vis-a-vis the assassination of Robert Kennedy. Interestingly enough, Manny Pena was also working for Senator Dodd's committee and was actually involved in tracing down the telescopic sight on the rifle supposedly owned and used by Lee Harvey Oswald. I am touching on that speculative note raised by Peter Dale Scott because there has been an item that is gaining increasing circulation in the firearms publication business, I guess one could say. Publications like Guns and Ammo, American Rifleman, and others have called attention to an alleged link between the Third Reich's firearms control legislation and the 1968 Gun Control Act authored by Senator Thomas Dodd, again, whose political pedigree goes all the way back through the American Security Council, the FBI, all the way back to the American prosecutorial staff at Nuremberg, that less than vigorous prosecutorial staff. It has been alleged by many observers, and this has received a fair amount of circulation in right-wing literature, that the 1968 U.S. Gun Control Act is very closely based on the 1938 Gun Control Act implemented by the Third Reich. I have a copy of the Third Reich law. It is, of course, in German, and I have a comparison, a lengthy comparison, of the American Gun Control Act of 1968. Unfortunately, I don't speak German, and this would be a massive project to compare the two, but there certainly appear to be some strong similarities, and it has been alleged in right-wing literature that, in fact, the 1968 U.S. legislation was based in large measure on the 1938 Third Reich legislation. I do not know how accurate those allegations are. I do think that they should be looked at and investigated very thoroughly to see if, in fact, those allegations are accurate. Because the functioning of Senator Dodd with regard to investigating the American firearms mail order business, Mr. Dodd's background with the FBI, with the American Security Council helping to float the disinformation about Oswald and Bogdan Stashinsky, as well as Dodd's participation in the Nuremberg situation, raises some interesting questions about that 1968 Gun Control Act. Senator Dodd was one of the principal figures involved in its implementation, and I have been looking at gun control in the context of the martial law contingency plans, which were developed under the Reagan and Bush administration, in turn growing out of political developments in the Nixon administrations. And it is my considered belief that in the event of an economic catastrophe in the United States, either part or all of the country will be placed under martial law. And it is also my considered opinion that the hue and cry over gun control, assault weapons, etc., is directly connected to the possibility of martial law. We're hearing an awful lot about crime. Well, crime is going down. And indeed, there's never been any proven connection whatsoever between assault weapons and murder. And we're going to discuss that at greater length, either in tonight's program or in next week's broadcast, if time does not permit us to get into that this evening. But I do want to emphasize that many of the focal points of the program this week and next week will be speculative in nature and should be emphatically understood as such. I do not know if, in fact, the allegations, for example, made by some of the firearms publications people as well as right-wing literature about the connections between the Nazi 1938 Gun Control Act and the American Gun Control Act of 68, authored by Thomas Dodd of the Nuremberg prosecutorial staff. But in light of some of Thomas Dodd's other activities and in light of the context in which his name crops up in the investigation into President Kennedy's assassination, I think it's something worth evaluating very carefully. Broadcast this evening and possibly next week as well may very well go into the archives as a program entitled The Seeds of Nuremberg, but we'll see. At the very least, the material about eugenics is going to go into the archives as an addendum to the archive show about the Tiergartenstrasse 4 program, and the material about Thomas Dodd, the 1968 American gun control legislation, and Dodd's fascinating series of connections will be going into the archives as an addendum to Purdy's Last Stand, a miscellaneous archive show dealing with the Stock and Schoolyard massacres in early 1989. So that is what we have on tap for this evening and possibly next week as well. We're going to take a musical break now, and when we come back, we're going to be engaging in the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program.